My guest, William Crystal, is part of the group of policy experts, historians, officials, and journalists who were calling for regime change in Iraq long before the attacks of September 11th. Crystal is the chair of the group The Project for the New American Century, a think tank which describes its goal as promoting American global leadership by maintaining the preeminence of its military forces. In 1998, the project wrote a letter to President Clinton calling for regime change in Iraq. It was signed by 18 prominent policy experts, including Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, and Richard Perle. In 2000, the project issued a report titled Rebuilding America's Defenses. Some experts, like our previous guest, Joseph Cirincione, consider this report a blueprint for the Bush administration's foreign and defense policies. Crystal is also the editor of the influential magazine The Weekly Standard and served as Vice President Dan Quayle's chief of staff. He's co-authored the new book, The War Over Iraq. I asked Crystal how the war in Iraq fits into the larger doctrine he advocates.
You know, one shouldn't over-explain, if I can use that word, the war in Iraq. We've been in conflict with Iraq for, 12, 13 years. President Clinton almost did come to blows with Iraq, certainly. We bombed Iraq. We enforced no-fly zones against Iraq. We even threatened a major war against Iraq in 1998. It shouldn't be a great mystery or surprise that this might come to a war. So I wouldn't want to exaggerate the importance of the doctrine. Having said that, I think it's also true that if you look at the Bush doctrine, if you look at some of the arguments we've made, Iraq's not an entirely isolated case. Saddam isn't the only dictator developing weapons of mass destruction. He's not the only problem. And if you think, post 9/11, that the choice is to confront these problems or to not confront them and then have them confront you, then there will be more problems to confront even when we finish with Saddam.
Part of the Bush doctrine, part of the doctrine underlying the war in Iraq, is the idea that sometimes preemptive action is necessary, and this is the first time the United States has acted preemptively in going into a country with the military to overthrow a regime. Why do you support the idea of preemptive action, and it's something that you supported before this war actually happened?
Yeah, I do support it in this case, Terry. I would emphasize that it's not something that should be done recklessly or too often, obviously. And I would also emphasize that it's not quite as new as people sometimes pretend. When you think about it, President Kennedy's threats against Cuba in 1962, his statement that it was unacceptable that Castro have nuclear weapons in Cuba, and the embargo, which is an act of war that we put on Cuba, was a kind of preemptive action. Castro hadn't attacked us, and we didn't know that those nuclear weapons would be used against us, and we, in fact, probably had a pretty effective deterrent against them at the time. Having said that, I won't deny that this is a bigger effort, and even though I could argue that we're responding in some respects to Saddam's violation of UN agreements and agreements with us, which I think is true, it's also true that when you look at the president's rationale for this war, it is preemptive in an important way, which is to say that what the president has said, and I agree with this, is that if you look at Saddam's history, this particularly brutal tyrant, that the prospect of allowing him to continue developing weapons of mass destruction is unacceptable, and that we don't feel compelled to be attacked directly first, or attacked indirectly first through a terrorist group, before attacking him. And I would simply say, looking backwards, if we could have preemptively gone after al-Qaeda and removed the Taliban government in Afghanistan before September 11th, wouldn't that have been a good idea? If we could have preemptively removed Hitler, incidentally, wouldn't that have been a good idea? In the past, we have waited until we were attacked. That's not something I'm particularly proud of, frankly, to have waited till December 1941 to get into the Second World War. Many historians, I think most of us in school even, learned that that was probably a mistake. That was due to a kind of American isolationism and inward-looking in the 30s. So I think this doctrine, the exercise of this doctrine in Iraq is somewhat new, but when you think about it, it's a reasonable decision to make given the dangers that are out there.
You're the chair of the group called the Project for a New American Century, and in the founding principles of this group, it says that the United States should, among other things, purposefully promote American principles abroad. And that certainly fits with the idea of trying to transform the world through the spread of democracy, for example, going into Iraq, overthrowing the regime, creating a democracy there in the hopes that democracy will then take root and spread through the Middle East, which is an idea that you endorse. Joseph Cirincione, who was just on the show, said that you can't you can't create democracy through the point of bayonets, that you can't go and invade a country and then create democracy there. That's not the way it's done. What's your reaction to that?
Well, of course, it is the way we've done it in Germany and Japan and elsewhere.
But Germany and Japan, that was after they were already defeated. You know, there'd been a long...
Well, we're not going to...
There'd been a long
war.
We
didn't,
but I mean, we didn't go in there just like we're going to overturn that regime and create democracy. That creating the democracy was the kind of result after a long war that.
It's going to be different. Not that different, Terry. I mean, here we're going to do it after a short war, and it's not the reason we're doing it. I am not for invading every Arab country that's not a democracy and imposing democracy. Having judged that Saddam with weapons of mass destruction is unacceptable, then the question becomes: do we, as we've done in the past, in effect accept the substitution of one thug for another thug, or do we decide that these deals we've been making with Arab dictators have been a mistake in many respects, or whether they were justified or not 20 or 30 years ago, no longer are really the way to go? And having taken upon ourselves the responsibility of removing the regime in Iraq, something I strongly support, I think it would be irresponsible to say, well, we've taken out the current regime, let's just let there be chaos or let the strongest thug sort of take over. We have some responsibility to try to help the Iraqi government create a decent regime. This is not quite as bold a departure as people say. And in fact, I would challenge other people. Do they really want us to go to the war, to go to war and then not try to create democracy afterwards?
Well, the other option is to not go to war.
Correct. No, that's a legitimate argument. In other words, to say that the threat of Saddam with weapons of mass destruction is not a decisive enough threat that it warrants this war. But having gone to war, I actually think we have very little choice as a country that believes democracy is good for people and that believes that people have the right to at least have an effort, make a good effort to govern themselves, that we have the right, once we're in effect in control of the country, to help them set up a decent and democratic government. I also think it would have good effects elsewhere in the Middle East. I don't believe that Arab nations are condemned forever not to have democracies. So I'm very much for this. But again, it's not the prime reason for going to war.
Do you think that we might have underestimated the force of nationalism, that although the people of Iraq hate Saddam Hussein, they don't necessarily like the United States. They don't necessarily see us as their liberators? You know, a lot of people in that part of the world see the United States as the opponent, as the imperialist or the colonizer. Most of the people in the United States are not Islam. A lot of the people in Iraq might hope that there's an Islamic government if Saddam Hussein falls. The Shiites might be hoping for an Islamic government, not an American-style democracy.
Yeah, well, there's several points there. Look, no, nationalism makes a difference. An awful lot of Germans fought very hard against the U.S. in March of 1945, and they probably despised Hitler and knew they were going to lose, for that matter. But there is a kind of nationalism that rises up. That's inevitable. I would resist the notion, though, that because some Iraqi troops and a few Iraqi irregulars are causing trouble for the American force, that means that the great bulk of the Iraqi people are hostile to the American invasion or you know, somehow supporting Saddam's government against us. Look, of course, many nations in the Middle East, many people in the Middle East aren't going to love America. They're predominantly of a different religion than most Americans are, and they may want to shape their lives in different ways than what they see on TV as being the kind of American way of life, and that's certainly their right. That doesn't mean that they deserve the really corrupt and tyrannical governments they often have, and it doesn't mean that we can't play a role in helping them. I don't think we need to pretend that we're going to create them in our own image. We just need to try to secure for them some basic human rights that I think we do believe that everyone is entitled to. And on this issue of the Shia in Iraq, I think there's been a certain amount of, frankly, Terry, a kind of pop sociology in America that, you know, somehow the Shia can't get along with the Sunni, and the Shia in Iraq just want to establish some kind of Islamic fundamentalist regime. There's almost no evidence of that at all. Iraq's always been very secular. The Shia in most Iraqi countries are less fundamentalist and more inclined to be for some kind of pluralism and tolerance, since they're a minority in almost every Arab country. And, of course, as a sect within Islam, they've been a minority for forever, really, for over a century. So I'm reasonably hopeful about Iraq. It's not going to suddenly become, you know, an American-style liberal democracy with everyone, you know, being wonderfully tolerant and pluralistic and even politically correct to each other. But America didn't become that overnight either. And even a, you know, even a somewhat fractious and tense and a little bit unstable semi-democracy in Iraq would be such an unbelievable improvement over the horrible brutality they've been subject to that I'd be proud to help bring that about. And I think it would have a good effect, actually, elsewhere in the Middle East.
In talking about the Shia, what about Iran? I mean, the Iranian government is a Shia fundamentalist government.
It is, and that was, you know, a very unfortunate reaction to the Shah and to his mistakes, I think, in governing. And, and most of the Iranian people, who, as you absolutely correctly say, are Shia, are very unhappy with the Iranian government. And I think you would agree that almost every expert on Iran believes that the huge majority of Iranian Shia, having experienced fundamentalism for two decades, very much want a more liberal, pluralistic society. I think one of the great agenda items for the U.S. government over the next year or two or three is helping foster and aid the forces for pluralism and toleration in Iran. We can debate exactly how to do that, and do we help the liberal reformers in the government, or do we help the student demonstrators in the street and civil society? Do we do some of both? I think this is a big challenge, actually, for the U.S. government to be more imaginative in its diplomacy in helping push Iran further down the path towards getting rid of the theocratic government they're unfortunately saddled with. But I would cite Iran precisely to prove my point that, you know, a great majority of the Iranian people who are Shia very much want a more pluralistic and liberal form of government.
The war in Iraq is, in a way, the first chapter in acting out a doctrine that has existed for several years now, one that you've endorsed and helped write, which has to do with preemptive action, acting unilaterally, not necessarily in concert with the UN or even with NATO, and trying to, you know, overturn a regime that is not in the United States' best interest, and then trying to promote democracy there. Where do you see this heading after Iraq? Like,
well, that's not,
for example, we're faced with regimes in Iran and with North Korea that look like they're about to become nuclear powers. North Korea, in particular, could export nuclear weapons to terrorists if it wanted to. Where do we go with those two countries if we follow the direction of Iraq?
Well, I think those are the two biggest challenges probably facing us right after Iraq, as the president himself has basically said a year ago when he characterized those three as the axis of evil. Iran, I think we have a very good shot at using political and diplomatic pressure and inducements to bring about a peaceful, really, change of regime there. I think we should help the Iranian people achieve regime change if we can. The worrisome thing is the drive by the Iranian government to get nuclear weapons. They're a couple of years away. You know, whether we can be much stricter in terms of cutting off their access to certain things that would help them, that have helped them develop these weapons. We've been pretty weak, I think, the U.S. government has, in pressuring countries like Russia and China to stop proliferating material that help other countries go nuclear. In North Korea, we have a big problem. They already have a couple of nuclear weapons, it looks like, and they have this ability to kill hundreds of thousands, probably, of South Koreans if a war were to start, and in fact some tens of thousands of American troops there too. But we can't let North Korea, and I think there's bipartisan agreement on this, we can't let North Korea become a nuclear assembly line. So we may have to again see if maybe we can cut a deal with that regime, distasteful as that would be, since it's such a horrible regime, starving its own people. We may have to embargo or quarantine North Korea. I suppose a military option has to be retained as a sort of last option, though it's very risky and dangerous on that little peninsula over there. But look, these aren't choices that come from my doctrine or George Bush's doctrine. These are choices that come from the real world. And the truth is, if I had never written a word, and if the Weekly Standard went out of business tomorrow, which I certainly hope doesn't happen, and, you know, Al Gore were president instead of George Bush, you'd still have a huge problem with North Korea. Bill Clinton almost went to war with North Korea in 1994, and would still have a big challenge in Iran. So, you know, the real world trumps all doctrines, and in this case, we just have some real challenges out there that have to be dealt with.
Do you think we'll be dealing with these options with a weakened United Nations and a weakened NATO, and how does that affect us?
I think NATO, I'm a strong believer in NATO, and I think we can strengthen it. Last weekend, I and some of my colleagues in the Project for the New American Century co-signed a letter with some Democrat, mostly former Clinton administration officials, many of them at Brookings, some of them at Brookings, endorsing a stronger role for NATO in the reconstruction of Iraq. And I think NATO, and what we say in this letter, is that NATO could actually play a big role in helping with some of the security tasks of a new Iraq. I'm more dubious about the UN. I think it's mostly weakened itself. I mean, the UN was, of course, pretty useless during the Cold War when we were at loggerheads with the Soviets and we both had vetoes on the Security Council. People had great hopes in the UN beginning in the 90s, and obviously in 1990, the first President Bush in 1991 was able to use the UN to put together the coalition in the Gulf. But since then, in all honesty, it's not been a terribly useful instrument for dealing with major security challenges. It can do lots of useful things and humanitarian aid and peacekeeping and in other respects, but it failed in the Balkans, basically, and it failed certainly in Rwanda, and it hasn't been very successful in dealing with Saddam. And I'm a little dubious, actually, about the utility of the United Nations. This isn't a theological position of mine. If it's useful, that's fine. I just think in practice it has not been terribly helpful in dealing with the real threats that are out there. But I'm not a unilateralist. I mean, we need to work with other countries. We may need to look at new institutional arrangements. We may need to look at reviving or reforming older institutional arrangements like the United Nations Security Council. And again, this shouldn't be a partisan matter. There's no reason, frankly, why American liberals should sort of have such a theological faith in the UN that they think that the current structure of the UN Security Council is handed down from on high and that, that has to exist forever. So I think a healthy debate could be had if we can get beyond this unilateralist, multilateralist kind of name-calling. And I think that's something that could happen over the next year or two and that could be pretty helpful.
You have, argued intellectually for a point of view that is now actually being followed with the war in Iraq. And I'm wondering what it's like for you to see something that had been like an intellectual point of view, a theory that you've deeply believed in and have written about, you've published reports about it, it's been expressed a lot in your magazine, The Weekly Standard. So this intellectual point of view, this theory, is now actually being tested in Iraq, and the war looks like it's going to be a lot longer than planned, and people are dying on both sides. I'm just wondering what it's like for you to see the idea tested in reality and to see the consequences of the test. And I'm not saying that the idea is right or wrong, but that, once you start a war, there are consequences. There are deaths on both sides. Even if the war ended in one day, there probably have been deaths on both sides. But so what's it like for you to play out, particularly given that things seem to be kind of chaotic right now?
No, look, you're absolutely right. It is this. It's one feels some responsibility. Obviously, I'm not a policymaker, but I will say this: I think whether it was Paul Wolfowitz or me or Bob Kagan, we're all people who served in government, and we didn't develop this just as an intellectual exercise. I mean, we've never been flip, I don't think, about the kinds of things we were proposing. These weren't just mind games to make people think outside the box. We thought these were the right policies, and obviously people are more than entitled to say no, they're the wrong policies. But so in that respect, it's not quite as startling, perhaps, to see them in practice. We've always tried to think through their implications in practice. I'll give you one instance. In December 1997, we had a cover of Saddam Moscow of the Weekly Standard. It was the height of one of the crises with the inspectors, and we'd become convinced, as in fact Clinton became convinced, that the inspection regime wasn't working and that we had to, Clinton threatened force in February 98. We thought we actually had to use force. And one of the articles we had in that magazine by that issue was by Fred Kagan, who teaches military history at West Point. And it said we're going to have to use ground troops to get rid of them. This is not going to be an antiseptic bombing campaign, and we might even need to use 250,000 ground troops because this is a serious regime. It's a big country, and there'll be casualties. So we've always, I think, to be fair to us, we've always taken this seriously. So I'm willing to be serious, and I think your question is right about this. I mean, that one has to be serious about the consequences of what one's recommending and take some responsibility for it, or at least take some responsibility for thinking it through seriously. And, we'll have to be judged by the results. I mean, does this ultimately contribute to a safer world, to a safer country, to a better life for the people of Iraq and or not? And more broadly, does our doctrine make sense? Is it a better alternative for the world than the than the competing doctrines. The one thing I'd say, I don't want to go on too long, but the one additional point I'd make is, you know, it's the fairest way to compare, obviously, anyone's proposals is to compare them with the other real-world alternatives. So, you know, the question is, if we weren't pursuing this strategy, what other strategy would we be pursuing, and what would the risks and the costs of that be? You know, you can't compare any strategy to sort of a best case. You know, we'd all love a peaceful world with no Saddam, no tyranny, no horrible brutality within Iraq, no weapons of mass destruction. That's not an alternative. So the question is, removing him through war or counting on inspections or accepting the fact that he has weapons of mass destruction, whatever. But one has to compare real-world alternatives, not unrealistic ones.
Well, Bill Kristol, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
William Kristol is the chair of the Project for the New American Century, editor of the Weekly Standard, and co-author of the new book, The War Over Iraq. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.